Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Glad to have you listening to the latest conversation in our pandemic science and research coverage. This hour, how will the experience of vaccine development in the midst of a pandemic shape vaccine science beyond the pandemic? And how is the experience of the pandemic influencing scientific study of infectious diseases? We begin this morning with Dr. Christine Peterson. She's director of the Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases at the University of Iowa. It's a pleasure to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We're watching the emergence of these variants, and we're getting a lot of warnings from public health leaders about how quickly this UK variant is spreading. And it comes at a moment when we're seeing cases drop and hospitalizations drop, and I think people are feeling like we're glimpsing the other side of the pandemic. So given all that, I'd like to know where you think we are in the arc of the pandemic.
I think, you know, the case numbers where they currently stand are looking up after a pretty dark November and December. It's been great to see that trend move downward. But it is true with these new variants, which all evidence shows do have more ability to transmit between people. The drumbeat from public health professionals, appropriately so, has been, come on, guys, let's not drop our guard. We're not out of the woods yet, because all the evidence about what level of herd immunity we will need in order to stop transmission is that we need to get upward of 60, 70, maybe 80%. And that's going to be a while before we get there.
So would you say we are more than halfway through the pandemic? Do the variants really introduce an unknown into kind of the idea of the arc of the pandemic? How do you factor them in?
Looking at other respiratory viruses that spread globally still, like influenza, might inform this somewhat. Of course, you know, none of us have crystal balls, so none of us know exactly. But what we've seen with the flu is that that virus also is an RNA virus, which means it has that sloppy copying and does lead to mutations that change the nature of the virus. This is also what we're seeing with coronavirus. And that means that our tools like vaccines will need to be tweaked in order to continually provide protection. So although I think we've learned a lot in the last year about this novel coronavirus, I have a feeling that, like many of these viral foes, we're going to need to keep working to stay ahead of it. And I hate to say it, but I have a feeling that this might be a virus that, like the flu, stays with us, and we just need to kind of constantly keep up with it.
I mean, I think I hear you saying there will be outbreaks, maybe not at the level that we're seeing through this pandemic, but in the years that follow, we will see outbreaks, and we'll have to do some of the things that we're doing now to stop those outbreaks. Is that right?
That is what I am saying, yes.
Wow.
What we're seeing already in this last year is that this virus can have mutations that lead to changes in its ability to spread between people. And the evidence is already starting to be seen that that changes the ability of the vaccines that we already developed to protect against them, which means that we can't be complacent and have to, you know, make new tools. And we will probably, if those tools aren't readily available, have situations where we might go back to mask wearing or other prevention measures in the meanwhile.
You know, I've been wondering about the difference in the way the world responded to the original SARS. And although that spread, it was able through some luck and prevention and really jumping on it quickly, techniques, from turning into the kind of pandemic that we've seen with SARS-CoV-2. What is the difference between what happened with the original SARS and what did not happen with SARS-CoV-2 that put us in the kind of situation that we're in?
I guess the first place to start is the viruses, although certainly similar, are not exactly the same. And the evidence that we have is that our new SARS coronavirus 2 is much more transmissible between people, which means that it was kind of more ripe for spreading further. And then, you know, all of us wish that politics didn't play a major role in what happens with these pandemics, but it does. And I think we are now learning that something that we thought started, you know, right around the New Year or the Chinese New Year, depending on who you talk to last year, you know, really was starting to spread in December of 2019. And there's evidence from various databases that were actually used to look at flu and other respiratory diseases that it had spread to multiple locations outside of China already prior to the turn of the new year. So, you know, some of it was people not jumping on it right away, trying to suppress information, and then, you know, not great messaging and not really getting on board. And then I guess the third thing I'd like to bring up is that we did have some really good pandemic prevention and surveillance teams. And unfortunately, funding for those got cut in, you know, 2018, 2019, which really left us flat-footed.
Since we've talked about China, we know that WHO investigators have been working in China to try to determine the origin of the virus. And let's also acknowledge that there have been some political influences, right, on, you know, what China says about that, what the United States has said about it. One of the team leaders recently came out to say, we can almost eliminate the possibility that it came out of a lab. I mean, Donald Trump was saying that for a while. He's taken that off the table. I guess what I'm asking you is, as an epidemiologist, and you start to see the evidence for how this spread in China, it looks like some of these open markets were influential with this. Are you taking information out of this and saying, I can see a framework coming together where we really stop a virus jumping from an animal population into a human population?
It was really the reports coming out of China indicating that we had a new virus from a live market source epidemiologically that raised my attention, you know, in January 2020, because that is where SARS-1 came from as well. And, you know, as someone who really is fascinated and has spending my career looking at that interface of spillover of things jumping from other mammals into people, I do think that that's a place that we need to have continued focus and consideration. You know, last year there were calls to close those wet markets or live markets just because of the risks that they pose. But it turns out that that isn't nearly as simple as it sounds. Because if you think about that globally, there are lots of places where, you know, people are going to have to use wildlife as sources of food. And, you know, I know even graduate students in the Midwest are eating a lot more venison in this last year than maybe they did before. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think we need to recognize that that is a risky source, and especially having live animals stacked atop each other with not fantastic hygiene is really a recipe for disaster. But at the same time, we have to realize that we can't just say that, you know, these have to be banned and that, you know, using wildlife as a food source is wrong because of the challenges of what that means for a lot of people with less financial resources to, you know, purchase chicken or beef or whatever is the going protein source.
Well, it makes me wonder because we're starting to see these predictions from global public health leaders that, yes, there seems to be a span of 80 to 100 years between these, you know, global pandemics. But given the given what you've just said and some of the other factors here, there's a great concern that timeline shrinks and that it isn't 80 to 100 years before we see the next global pandemic. We see the next virus jump from an animal population to a human population. Do you see some indications that these predictions might be right on, that this might be something that is a much more, you know, kind of urgent danger in the decades ahead?
Yeah, that is what I believe. I think these diseases that can hop from other animals to people, known as zoonoses or zoonotic diseases, with the same beginning as the word zoo, they are diseases that we're seeing with increased frequency. So we had Zika that was really worrying us, especially among pregnant women, happen only about 4 years ago. And before that, you know, there was a really big avian influenza outbreak that caused 62 million chickens and turkeys to be killed. And before that, we had the new flu pandemic, which came out of birds. So there really has kind of been this more frequent drumbeat. Not all of them, thank goodness, have been as massive as what we've seen in this last year. But we are seeing them with increased frequency that probably has to do with, you know, more people on the planet, increased incursions into wild areas where we're interfacing with these viruses that have probably always been there. And then, you know, the global nature of our world, which we all know has wonderful aspects, but does lead to, you know, increased ability for things to hop from one side of the planet to others rather quickly.
You're listening to our latest conversation in our pandemic science and research coverage, and we're having a discussion this hour about how the experience of the pandemic influencing the scientific study of infectious diseases is going on. Dr. Christine Peterson is with us. She's director of the Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases at the University of Iowa. I also want to bring Dr. Kelly Moore now into the conversation because I also want to talk about the experience of vaccine development in the midst of this pandemic and how that is going to shape vaccine science beyond the pandemic. Dr. Moore is the deputy director of the Immunization Action Coalition. It's a group that works to increase immunization rates and prevent disease in support of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Moore, welcome back to the show. Good to have you here.
It's great to be back, Carrie. Thank you.
Dr. Moore, we started with Dr. Peterson and talking about these variants and how they may be influencing the arc of the pandemic and what they mean for, I guess, the next 45 to 60 days. We keep hearing that vaccination efforts are going to have to accelerate to get ahead of the variant, and even then, it may not be possible to get ahead of the B.1.1.7. This UK variant. Where are we in your view of vaccination versus this particular variant?
Well, I think that we are picking up speed. We had a slow start. We expected a slow start. I think, unfortunately, the experts in the vaccination world were more prepared for the bumps in the road at the beginning than the public was led to expect. So, but finally, I think we are beginning to pick up our speed. We're now exceeding 1 million doses a day administered across the country. That's not where we want to be. We would like to be, frankly, closer to 2 million doses a day. But we are working hard to begin to align the distribution and administration with the supply we have available. Ideally, you have supply coming out into the community and being used promptly, just in time for the next shipment to arrive. And we're getting close to that. But I think that we are flying a little bit blind when it comes to these variants. We're getting a better idea of where B.1.1.7, this particular variant, is in the country. But I think we need to realize we haven't been doing surveillance in the United States for these variants very aggressively until just recently. And as a result, We are just now getting a sense of how widespread it is. And the CDC has already said they expect this variant to become the dominant, most common form of COVID-19 by sometime in April, most likely. So we have to work quickly, but with vaccination to try to protect as many vulnerable people as possible, as quickly as possible. There are a couple of good things, though, that I can say about this particular variant. One is that it looks like it is more contagious, more transmissible from one person to another, but early estimates have been downgraded in our consideration. So we think it's about 30 to 40% more transmissible instead of 70 or 80% more transmissible. So that's good news. The other good news is that the vaccines work well against this particular variant. We don't have a lot of data yet, but what we see suggests that the vaccines are very effective at preventing severe illness, hospitalization, and certainly death in vaccine recipients, even with this variant. And so that's reassuring, but we are now in the process across the country of establishing surveillance for this variant as well as other variants that we know exist and new ones that could emerge. Because every time this virus infects another person, it has another opportunity to find a way to do its job better. And the only way to stop that is to vaccinate and slow it down and prevent those infections, prevent those opportunities to mutate.
So, Dr. Moore, just a quick question here about, you mentioned surveillance. Testing, as you know, took a long time to ramp up. We're still not testing, I hear many leaders saying, at the level that we should be. And what happened there was we were undercounting, right, the number of cases, the kind of the level of transmission. So are we testing enough to know the true level of transmissibility of this variant? Or are we really just guessing about where it is?
One thing that is useful is that we can learn from the work of other countries. So this particular variant was first detected in the UK. We don't really know where it came from, but the UK, Great Britain, has been doing a phenomenal job of surveillance. And we have good information from them about the early emergence of this particular variant. And a lot of our information can come from their experience with how they're studying this virus. We have phenomenal colleagues, virologists, who are working there and collaborating with folks in the CDC and researchers here in the U.S. to help us better understand these variants. But your point is well taken. We need to maintain and increase testing so that we're more rapidly identifying people who are infected and can make sure that they're isolating themselves and not spreading that virus on to other people. Even imperfect tests that identify a good number of people who are infected, if it makes them change their behavior and keeps them inside, keeps them from spreading the virus, that's a good thing. However, those quick tests are not the ones that are going to give us our genetic analysis. Those require the nasal swabs and tests that are sent on to labs that can then do genetic sequencing. So we need both sophisticated tests as well as simple tests, but we do need a lot more of them to have a better idea of where we are now and how to change the course of where we're going.
Dr. Peterson, we have talked at length about the mRNA technology on this show, so I don't want to go back over that. But I was reading something that was published in Nature recently saying essentially now that mRNA vaccines have been shown to work, it might lead to much more rapid vaccine development for new emerging infectious diseases. Since that's your focus on infectious diseases, I mean, how hopeful are you that when you see one of these, as we've said, this virus jump from an animal community to a human population, that we can swoop in quickly and develop a vaccine thanks to the mRNA technology that's in use?
Yeah, the mRNA vaccine technology, something that really had not been approved for human use before this year, really can make that ability to switch in and out the portion of the virus that's being targeted with much more rapidity than the previous vaccines that focused on proteins or other parts. And I do think that that's going to be a really useful tool going forward, because it really decreases the timeline to get us to the new vaccine that can be targeted to, you know, for instance, the UK strain or the South African strain. And honestly, I think it's going to help us not just for coronavirus, but for other viruses as well.
Wow. Dr. Moore, I guess to also let our listeners know that this mRNA technology has been in the lab for a long time. I don't want people to think, again, I know this has been part of the vaccine hesitancy, oh, it's brand new. We don't really know how it works in vaccines. It's been studied for a long time. But as Dr. Peterson is acknowledging, first time for use in vaccines, what difference do you think it makes in the way that we think about where vaccines fit in to infectious disease?
Well, I think you bring up, Carrie, an excellent point. People may not realize that actually decades of work have been done on this, what we call mRNA platform. In other words, a design to deliver mRNA for immune system purposes. The real focus of mRNA technology was actually in oncology and cancer treatment before we ever considered it for the development of human vaccines. And so I think one of the things that this points out is the enormous value of basic science research and of investing in basic science and not putting blinders on how we look at what we are developing as tools to fight infectious diseases. One of the things that a group that I work with called the Sabin-Aspen Vaccine Science and Policy Group, it's a pretty long name, but just a group of people from a lot of disciplines around the world who get together once a year and think big thoughts about vaccines and the future of vaccines and how we can better tackle infectious diseases. And one of the things that we talked about in our most recent meeting was the need for orchestrating a multidisciplinary basic science researchers and using lessons learned from other disciplines to tackle big problems in infectious disease. You know, we have the big problem of influenza. Every year we have to have a new vaccine. Wouldn't it be right, extraordinary to have a universal flu vaccine that only required, you know, a shot every 5 or 10 years like a tetanus booster? These mRNA vaccines are demonstrating to the world the benefits of basic science research, of multidisciplinary investments in these labs, like Dr. Peterson's, that can contribute answers to important questions in times of crisis. And we need to have a leadership structure in place, even a global organization, to be prepared to take advantage of the great work that's going on in basic science to answer important questions for humanity. And this is a terrific example of how we came together to answer these questions for SARS-CoV-2. But this is only one issue. There will be future infectious diseases we have to tackle. And in fact, there are current ones we haven't satisfactorily addressed yet. And so I'm very hopeful that we will take the lessons we've learned from this experience of this global emergency and not simply go back to business as usual in our own little isolated silos around the world doing what we feel like we want to do, but instead we will continue this scientific collaboration that can answer important questions and solve the problems of humanity when it comes to infectious disease. It's a terrific time.
Yeah, Dr. Peterson, I'm sure you do not want to think that you're in some isolated silo at the University of Iowa, but I am interested in whether you hear what Dr. Moore is saying, see the experience of this, and think there is a different way now to work in my laboratory, you know, kind of set out the mission for what we're doing. Has this changed the way you think about that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, even though I sit in Iowa, I spent my first 2 hours of this day Zooming with a whole collaborative team in India, fighting a neglected tropical disease. And I think these technologies will really make an importance, not just for SARS coronavirus 2, but across many different, you know, scourges that afflict people around the world. And I am also really excited that we've really kind of changed the way that the whole vaccine development is viewed in this last year. So I wholeheartedly agree that you know, that was on the backs of many, many basic scientists, and this didn't come out of nowhere. It came out of a lot of hard work. And, you know, as it was mentioned, it was a oncology background that led to these discoveries for the mRNA virus vaccine. But I really believe that it will open up whole new realms to fight these infectious scourges.
I'm Carrie Miller. You're listening to a discussion with Christine Peterson from the University of Iowa and Kelly Moore with us from the Immunization Action Coalition. It's a discussion about what the pandemic, this experience of seeing how this infectious disease spread globally, this investigation that's going on right now to try to figure out the origin of it, and what that means as we try to prevent future pandemics, and the experience of vaccine development in the midst of a pandemic, how that is shaping vaccine science beyond the pandemic. Dr. Moore, I really do have to come back to, and I think you and I have talked about this before, this vaccine hesitancy. But I just saw some newish numbers on this, and I am surprised to say that there is a significant amount of vaccine hesitancy among healthcare workers. I mean, we're seeing a level at 30 to 40% who are not saying they'll never get it, you know, in some counties and states, I should say, who are not saying that they'll never get it, but who are saying that they're going to wait. Do you have some insight on why frontline health workers would be so concerned about the effects of the vaccine?
Well, Carrie, I think that certainly when we talk about how to tackle this pandemic, you have two separate issues we're talking about today, the vaccines and vaccinations, and delivering the vaccines to the public, the vaccination process, is one that even frontline healthcare workers are people too. They have questions. They're not vaccine experts. And I think that there was a lot of nervousness among frontline healthcare workers because they were identified as the first recipients of these vaccines that had just received emergency use authorization. They're not fully licensed yet. They've been approved for use quickly with good data on their safety and effectiveness, but not as much data as we typically have for a routine immunization. So we acknowledge that there were some unknowns about these vaccines before we started using them, and that we would be answering those unknowns as we went forward and continued to do our research, but that the crisis caused by the pandemic was so severe that we could not wait to deploy valuable tools that could save lives right away. And we felt comfortable when we looked at the data from the clinical trials, looking at tens of thousands of vaccine recipients in the U.S. and other countries from all different walks of life, that we were seeing vaccines that were performing exceptionally well and with a very good safety profile. So we were comfortable with these, but the healthcare workers were the very first people that we were wanting to line up to get these vaccines before we learned everything there is to know about them. So I can understand that they still had questions. One of the things we can do to change people's minds is sit down with them, listen to their questions and concerns, and address them. I personally have had conversations with hesitant healthcare workers in a hospital setting, and within 5 minutes of just listening to what their worry was and addressing it to them directly, they went out smiling and ready to be vaccinated. And
wow.
So there's a lot of work to preparing people to choose to be vaccinated. And if we try to skip over that work because we know we have a great vaccine that is safe and that is going to save lives, we can't just assume that everyone else shares our enthusiasm because they haven't been working on this every day like I have. We need to take the time to bring the public along with us, to let them see our work, to let them see why we're so excited and enthusiastic, so that they will share that enthusiasm. And I'm afraid that we've been rushing this out so fast in this urgent situation that we maybe have skipped some steps of bringing people along to help them understand and choose to be vaccinated because they understand these vaccines. So we've got more work to do in that area, I think. And I'm hopeful that we can turn those numbers around as we do more.
Yeah, Dr. Peterson, you know, we don't want to ignore the political environment that all of this has happened in. And I know you're very aware of that, specifically in what's happened in Iowa with your governor. Set the politics aside for just a minute. What is the most important thing that you've learned about what hasn't worked in the distribution of vaccines so far, and that we better get right whenever the next pandemic hits and a vaccine is developed for it? What is that thing that you've said, okay, I get it now, and let's apply that the next time?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, it's not the way any of us maybe would have chosen to set it up, but we basically have 50 experiments going on right now. So you can kind of watch other places and see what's working and what's not working.
You mean in 50 different states?
In 50 different states, yeah. Exactly. And you could even break it down to, you know, county levels from there. But I think, you know, Iowa obviously is a rural state, and it has a population that is not often centrally located. It's an older population. And I think all of that comes with slightly different challenges. So if you look at states with similar demographics, like West Virginia, for instance, instead of trying to base the vaccine campaign on pharmacies that have chains like CVS or Walgreens, which is what was chosen to be the first way to get out to the long-term care facilities, West Virginia very successfully reached out across their board of pharmacists to look for where they had independent pharmacies, and really used that network very successfully to get the vaccines out across the state into those rural areas. And I think that sort of example of looking where you do have the network and tapping into it is a really good lesson learned, and something that could be used in Iowa specifically, because we do have a similar network of pharmacies and pharmacists that could be tapped into. And another thing that successful states have done to really reach those more rural populations is to recognize that there's other healthcare practitioners who do have a lot of expertise in vaccination. For instance, veterinarians have been used in multiple states as people who are literally driving trucks around with refrigeration and could be used to get vaccines to places that you don't have necessarily a brick and mortar hospital or a CVS or a Walgreens to use.
I mean, what you are really saying is we really needed somebody at the top to take control, whether that was the federal government, and then coordinate very closely with governors and not have governors say, and the president, President Trump, as he said, here it is, you figure it out. I mean, is that kind of your epiphany about the way this worked and didn't work?
Indeed. I think it's helpful to have more direction from the get-go, absolutely. But I think it's almost like, you know, what Dr. Moore was talking about, that, you know, when it comes to chain sort of interactions versus having somebody that you know being the provider of a vaccine, you're probably going to know exactly where that location is and trust the person who will be physically giving you the injection. And I think all of that matters too. I do think, for instance, in West Virginia, they did set up a very nice interface to schedule those appointments. And I think that network did help enormously in their rollout. And I do think that sort of central organization is very helpful when it can happen. But I think, you know, almost the flip side, that having those local connections then to actually provide it is also key.
Yeah. Dr. Moore, let me put this in a different way to you. In the next time that we have a pandemic and we need widespread vaccination, we will not do this. What is the this? Fill in the blank.
Well, I think there are a few things that we will not do. One is that we will not fail to prepare the public with good information as quickly as possible. We will not allow the states to go in 50 different directions on their own without a lot of support and coordination. I think we have seen how helpful it is in a crisis, and Dr. Peterson in her area would be aware of this as well. When people are in a crisis and fearful and anxious, and I have seen this on the front lines of the anthrax attacks and in the previous pandemic of 2009, people need good, clear, understandable information and an explanation of the process of how we're going to deal with the things we don't know yet. And people need to hear that clear, unified message and see a consistent response and behavior from their leadership, political and scientific. And that consistency and clear communication. In the next pandemic, of course, there will still be unknowns. There will still be issues with supply of any future vaccine being far short of the demand. Early on, before we have enough vaccine, we're still in the next pandemic going to have to make choices about who gets vaccine first. So all of those things will still happen every time, but we can handle them differently if we give the people clear information. We say when we don't know something, and we tell them how we're going to figure it out. And we get it up in front of the cameras every day with our best experts, Dr. Fauci, Dr. Ann Schuchat, Dr. Walensky now, and we make sure that people are hearing information they can trust. And part of information you can trust is trusting people when they say, you know what, we don't know the answer to this. Expect new information. Expect things will change. And that sense of confidence and consistent response calms people down a lot. It allows them to listen and to cooperate with each other to do what is recommended by public health experts and to cope better with the shortage of vaccine supply relative to demand. So those are some of the things that I think we will do, I hope, differently next time.
I just want to note this, Dr. Peterson, because I've thought about this a lot in these discussions that we're having about the pandemic and the vaccine rollout. I think it has been difficult for Americans to understand that sometimes, you know, there's going to be uncertainty as science figures it out. And sometimes science is going to say one thing, and then 3 months later, when the research shows something else, science is going to say, leaders like Dr. Fauci, et cetera, now we understand this to be true. And you heard I got so many calls from people going, first they tell us don't wear the mask, then they tell us what. More understanding of, I guess, scientific method, I think, would be valuable in accomplishing what Dr. Moore is talking about. What's your view on that?
Oh, absolutely. I think, and honestly, it's things that we're doing in the classroom and amongst colleagues, is the more that we can have scientists go from what they would say in a scientific talk to what they need to be able to explain at the Thanksgiving table, for instance, to their families, the better we will all be off. And I really think that that's been a area of engagement in many of our students. They are very eager to try to learn those skills of communication and how to take, you know, things that people have probably forgotten if they ever learned it, science-wise, and remind people about, you know, the way that science, you know, we start with a hypothesis, but that isn't always true, and we need to fix what we did, and you know, we are really trying to use the best evidence that we have. And we will always get back to you when we learn something new. And I think that goes around the trust issues that, you know, I've found whether I'm working with clients or whether I'm working with people in my lab or whether I'm working with colleagues globally, if you tell them, here's what I know, here's what I don't know, but this is what I'm going to do to figure it out, that always leads to a better relationship and a better give and take in the future of how that information is going to be perceived.
If you've just gotten in on the show, Dr. Christine Peterson with us from the director of the Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases at the University of Iowa, and Dr. Kelly Moore with us, deputy director, of the Immunization Action Coalition. You can hear this discussion, how it's developed. We're talking about this experience of vaccine development in the midst of the pandemic and how this experience of the pandemic has influenced and will continue to influence the study of infectious diseases. Dr. Moore, I ran across an interesting op-ed in Stat News in which a former Surgeon General and a Georgetown vaccinologist who has been on the show with us, Angela Rasmussen, and some others are calling for a national vaccine holiday sometime this summer. It's a national holiday declared as such, concerts, big community events. And here's their thinking. The promise of National Vaccine Day, a day of commemoration and social restoration after months and months of social distancing, would encourage the country to get vaccinated in anticipation. Okay, who doesn't want a holiday? But it's that last part that I want to ask you about. Do you think that this idea that this is the moment when we all kind of formally come together again and there's fun stuff to do, and if you don't have your vaccine, you can't show up to some of these events. What do you think of the overall idea, and do you think it would work the way they're suggesting?
Well, this is the first time I'm hearing of it, and it's an interesting concept. I think that we do want people to understand the benefits of vaccination and be able to celebrate it. I think that one of the things we have done, perhaps too much, has been emphasized to people who are getting vaccinated now that they should not change their behaviors, that they still need to wear masks, to keep their distance, to behave just as if they hadn't been vaccinated, even though they have been. And there are reasons for that. There are good scientific reasons. We don't yet understand fully how well these vaccines work against these new variants. We do know there's a lot of virus out there. So if you're one of the 1 in 10 or 1 in 20 people who didn't respond to these vaccines, then you could still catch the virus if you're out in public. So we have good reasons to suggest that. However, I think we might have oversold the case to have it seem as if, well, it doesn't even matter, because then you have people saying, well, why, you know, I can't change anything,
right?
You know, if I get
right.
vaccinated. So I think that we need to do a better job of communicating to folks that this is a temporary moment. While there is so much virus out there, that we need to do everything in addition to vaccination to drive the counts of illness down in our communities, to pull the rug out from under this virus in every way we can right now, but that this is very temporary and that we will be enjoying the benefits of vaccination. Now, do I think that we could pick a day? I think the emergence of these new variants and the unanswered questions make me a little nervous about picking a day to drop our guard, but I think that we do need to provide people a vision of hope that we are on the right path to coming back to life. I won't say normal. I don't think any of us want to go back to 2019, frankly. I think we can do better. and we can do better, and things will always be a little different, but we can come back to life. And I think we do need to give people a vision of hope and looking forward to holidays with their families this year compared to what they experienced in November and December of last year. But that is contingent upon vaccination, and we do need to make sure that everyone has both access to vaccine and has an understanding of the vaccine and encouragement to get the vaccine so that they feel confident choosing to be vaccinated when it's their turn. And I think we do have a lot of work left to do in that respect, especially with some of our vulnerable minority groups that are especially hard hit right now and are especially concerned about the vaccine and perhaps distrustful of the medical establishment. So we've got a lot of work to do yet, but I do have that vision of hope, and I share that with Dr. Carmona and Dr. Rasmussen.
Yeah, Dr. Moore, I'm so happy to hear you address this idea that you got the vaccine, but life goes on in this miserable way that we've all been living it. So that is much more optimistic. So, Dr. Peterson, what is the, given our whole experience, January 2020 to February 2021, I know there are still a lot of unknowns. I'm curious about the question that, I don't know, wakes you up at night, animates your team at the lab. What is the unknown about this that is still intriguing to you?
Well, as a group that looks at, you know, where did this really come from and how did it move from animals to people, you know, we were all kind of really excited to see what the WHO investigation was going to say this week. Mm-hmm. I think we have a lot of questions about, you know, did it really just come right from bats? Was there another animal involved? How did it get into people? What was that exposure? You know, and what can we do to prevent that in the future? Because if we can nip it in the bud, that will help us all be safer in the long run. And really to learn about, you know, what are we doing that leads to these emerging infectious diseases? And how can we then do things that put us at less risk? At the end of the day, we need to know more about where these diseases come from and what are the risks that we take as people that make it more likely that it's going to spread across the globe. So if we can investigate, you know, what are the interactions that people have that lead them to getting these initial infections that are emerging from animals? And then what are the factors or the things people do that make it more likely to spread to the next person? That is what really, you know, fascinates my lab because of our interest in emerging infections. And it's further work in these places where people are interacting with animals that we're really interested in seeing what happens next.
I mean, the question about that is, and then will we follow the recommendations, right? Once we learn this?
Sure. And as I was talking about a little bit earlier with the live markets, how can we make sure that we are still providing people with the food that they want to eat from the places that they want to get them, but provide them with some additional safety and security as they do so?
Dr. Peterson, a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Dr. Moore, thank you. Good to talk to you again. I really appreciate all the insight and experience. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Carrie.
Dr. Kelly Moore is the Deputy Director of the Immunization Action Coalition. It's a group that works to increase immunization rates and prevent disease in support of the recommendations by the CDC. And Dr. Christine Peterson with us, Director of the Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases and a professor in the Department of Epidemiology at the University of Iowa.